Case for argument, United States v. Mokel. Mr. Connor.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Carrie Connor. I am here today on behalf of Michael Mokel. As we've outlined in our opening brief and again then in our reply brief, we raised several issues regarding the trial proceedings in Mr. Mokel's case. Among those are the evidence that was permitted to be admitted through the testimony of Mr. Mokel's daughter regarding a gun being pointed at her head, as well as testimony that was admitted through Lori Miller, who was Mr. Mokel's apparent short-time girlfriend, regarding Mr. Mokel at some point in time indicating that people would end up in the ground if they testified against him. We've also raised an issue regarding the constructive possession instruction. I think it's important in this case to go back to the superseding indictment because we did have originally four charges, two of which were acquittals. But the remaining two charges are very important in the sense that in count three, which is actually the 922 conviction, the government very specifically alleged what gun they had to prove Mr. Mokel possessed in order to convict him. And that was a 9mm Smith & Wesson with a very specific serial number. That gun connected back to a burglary from a hotel room of an individual named Mr. Batitas. Also, in count four, which there was a conviction on, there was a 9mm magazine and bullets found in a gun that Mr. Mokel was driving at the time of his arrest on May 15th. And again, it was the government's theory that that 9mm magazine went back to the same Batitas burglary. And I point that out to the court because throughout this record, Your Honors, there were numerous guns discussed, many times which could not in any way be connected back to the Batitas theft. There's no issue that many of the witnesses in this case were quite colorful. Virtually everyone who testified had a vested interest in the outcome of the case. None of the witnesses, including those that had illegally possessed firearms, engaged in burglaries and other activities, had been charged in the conduct. And in fact, Your Honors, what's really important and the reason I point out how specific the superseding indictment is that even the descriptions of guns that had been seen before the alleged burglaries in this case and after the alleged burglaries in this case in the possession of Mr. Mokel had varying descriptions. So ultimately, as to count three, the issue of whether or not, and count four, whether or not these clearly elicited comments from two witnesses over the objections of the defendant regarding what was in essence their fear of Mr. Mokel, not only did it have no relevance, but also clearly, because of the type of evidence that was admitted against Mr. Mokel, was clearly far from harmless and very prejudicial to the case. And I want to highlight the first of those, and that's the defendant's daughter, Michelle Arnold. She testified over the objection of the defense that her father had met her in a parking lot of a strip joint and pointed a firearm at her, feigning that he was going to rob her. It was absolutely clear from both the comments of the prosecution and the objection of the defense that this event preceded either of the two thefts at issue that would have resulted in the possession of the firearms. Yet, the government was permitted to question regarding this what is obviously a very not only irrelevant but clearly prejudicial event. It's unimaginable. A jury confronted by a young witness who is testifying that her father pointed a gun at her, whether jokingly or not, and somehow the jury would walk away with that from that without concerns about not whether or not the defendant committed the offense, but whether or not this was the type of defendant that needed to be taken off the street.
Was that gun that he used, does the argue that was the one that was stolen?
Your Honor, what was said at the sidebar was that this statement was made a few weeks before the thefts at issue. It was also described, I believe, as a silver and black firearm, which did not, in fact, meet the description of either of these firearms stolen. And I think it's extremely important because Ms. Arnold actually testified, I believe, to April 2008 that this is when this happened, when the burglaries at issue in this case did not occur until May.
Didn't
until
they clear
May.
Up a discrepancy about Ms. Miller, whatever you think you call it, the short-term
Arnold,
girlfriend?
Arnold, Your Honor. This I'm talking about now is the defendant's daughter.
I know, but that was supposedly concurrent when Ms. Miller was new dancing in the bar, wasn't it?
Yes.
And, now, that she was in prison on the day that what's-her-name said that this thing occurred, and it later found out that it occurred a little later because Ms. Miller is out of jail and dancing. Now, I may have got this mixed up. You say it was a colorful event. So okay.
Your Honor, actually what the testimony revealed is that Lori Miller, the short-term girlfriend, we'll call mm-hmm. her, that she worked at the strip club. However, she was actually in custody for 30 days, and the record reveals that her custody of that 30 days ended within, I believe, 2 days of the second burglary. She was in custody for 30 days, Your Honor.
Well, I don't know. I thought.
And my point being, it had to be before that, because my client was arrested within a week of Ms. Miller getting out
of
custody.
Well, maybe they can clear it up. I had a little bit of confusing in that, but I thought that was what they decided, that it had to be after she got out of jail down in Florida and was dancing and wherever this...
Well, I believe that Mr. Benson made that suggestion that maybe Ms. Arnold was off on her timing, but the reality is it's quite clear that that occurred in April of 2008, and in fact ultimately was argued by the government. I believe the quote, which is in my brief, is a few weeks before. So it clearly was elicited. It clearly was elicited with an attempt to basically prejudice the defendant before the jury. I think what's also important is at the time that that information was elicited and the government attempted to, for no better word, fudge on the timing, it was suggested by the defense that if, in fact, it was the gun that was relevant, that, in fact, Ms. Arnold could simply testify that she saw her father with a gun. But that was rejected by the court, and the government was permitted to, in fact, elicit, which is completely irrelevant and immaterial, that the defendant had actually pointed a gun at his daughter's head. And, Your Honors, that is absolutely no relevance to anything in the case, regardless if there's an attempt to fudge on when, in fact, that event occurred. What's also significant is what happened with Lori Miller. Lori Miller appeared. She was actually brought up from Florida where she was serving time on a drug case at the time of the trial, and she testified that Mr. Mokel at some point previously had suggested to her that if she talked, or in fact what she corrected herself is anybody talked, they would end up in the ground. As we've indicated in our brief and we've cited the cases to the court, it was absolutely inappropriate for that to be elicited.
How old is Mokel?
Mokel's in his 40s, Your Honor. I believe he's 45, Your Honor, but I may be off a year or two. And Ms. Miller, though, was allowed to testify to this, though at the time of her testimony, there was no indication that this had any relationship to any change in her testimony whatsoever. In fact, we were able to elicit from Ms. Miller that she had previously testified in five occasions, excuse me, not testified, but informed the agents during her cooperation on five separate interviews that the 9mm magazine was actually in her purse. And not only was it in her purse, but she had claimed to have brought it from Florida. It wasn't until, Ms. Miller explained, that the prosecutor in the case met with her just prior to trial and showed her pictures of the magazine that she concluded that she must have been wrong. So clearly, the statements, the alleged threats, had absolutely no bearing on what Ms. Miller was saying. And, in fact, it therefore was used to inappropriately boost or to inappropriately uplift what was clearly questionable testimony by Ms. Miller. I'd like to save the remainder of my time, if I might.
Thank you, Ms. Connor. Mr. Holler?
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. As the District Court did not abuse its discretion in any of its evidentiary rulings in this case, this Court should affirm the judgment. The defendants focused primarily, although she's raised other issues in her brief, on two pieces of testimony, those of Michelle Arnold, the defendant's daughter, and that of Lori Miller, the defendant's girlfriend. And in answer to your question, Judge Posner, I believe that Mr. Mokel was born in 1967, so that would make him about 43 or 44. His daughter was 20 at the time of trial. I believe she was 19 at the time of these incidents. Just to briefly clarify a few factual points that you asked about, Judge Mannion, the witness's testimony essentially was that a few weeks before her father was arrested, and the government sort of led her to say late April or early May is when the incident occurred. As Ms. Connor pointed out, Lori Miller was in jail. She got out on May 8th. And she was in jail for 30 days prior to that, so presumably back toward around April 8th. And Mr. Mokel was arrested on May 15th. So if Ms. Arnold was correctly remembering the incident, then she was somewhat wrong on the date, because Ms. Miller was in jail in late April, so it could not have occurred at that time period. Either it occurred not a few weeks, but many, many weeks before, well over a month before, or at a time period during which Ms. Miller testified the defendant didn't have any guns and there was no other evidence from any other witness that the defendant, who is a felon and doesn't have ready access to guns, would have had a gun, or she was, you know, I guess you could say lengthening out a one-week time period during which a whole bunch of stuff happened. She was breaking up and getting back together with her boyfriend. Her father was in and out of her life. He was displaying her guns, those kinds of things. And we believed that the jury could find that Ms. Arnold was correctly remembering the incident and she was misremembering the date. And therefore, the incident was relevant. The district court found that the jury could make that finding, that even though the witness was wrong on the date.
Who recited a date that may have been wrong?
Well, Ms. Arnold testified that
that's the daughter.
The daughter.
Yeah.
That the incident occurred a few weeks before the arrest and in late April or early May. So if it was a few weeks before May 15th, we'd be counting back to, you know, April 30th, May 1st, somewhere in that range. But she also said that the incident occurred in the parking lot of the Rising Sun Strip Club while Ms. Miller was inside working. And Ms. Miller was not inside working on April 30th or May 1st because she was in jail. She got out of jail on May 8th and went back to the strip club. So that was our position is, you know, people can remember incidents when they happen before and be wrong on the date. I could be asked, you know, 2 months from now, hey, when was that Mokel argument, and say, oh, I think it was in early or mid-April, and I would be wrong. It was on March 31st.
The incident's certain. She was in prison until
May 8th.
May 8th?
Yes.
And then she was dancing after that?
Yes.
And this confrontation in the car occurred while she was dancing?
Yes. The testimony about the specific incident is in the government's appendix. It's around page A39. You could sort of read the description of it. I mean, she says basically that we were at the Rising Sun. I told him to meet me there. It's in the brief, Your Honor, and I apologize.
Well, I'm looking at it from the standpoint of somebody reconciled the time. That's what they're arguing.
I understand that, Your Honor. On page 842 of our appendix, she's asked, Lori Miller wasn't there at the Rising Sun, was she? And the witness, Ms. Arnold, says she was inside. She was not in the car. She didn't see the incident, but she was inside the club. So, again, it's our position that the witness is misremembering the date, but she's correctly remembering the incident. The other point is, not only, therefore, could the jury find, this is a classic 402, Rule 403, there's some relevance, there's some reason to believe that the woman is correctly recognizing that her father had a gun, which would clearly be relevant to the charges, did he possess a firearm? And on the 403 side of the equation, you know, I want to correct one thing, which is that the witness never said that the defendant pointed the gun at my head. The witness said, you know, this is on 39 and 40 of the government's appendix. When I pulled up, he got in the car and pulled a gun and said how much he got. And I said, just 50, and he put it back. It wasn't meant to be a threat or a scare. It was just a joke. He was joking, right? Yes. And the district court, in making its balancing analysis of whether this was going to be admissible, was very keen on the fact that, listen, if this is perceived as a true threat, if he's really pulling out a gun and pointing it at her head and saying he's going to kill his daughter, I'm not letting that in. If it's clear, though, that this is a joking incident, then I find, in light of all the other evidence about this guy's behavior, this guy's a burglar, this guy's a drug user, and these were things that were coming in that were related to the instance itself, then I don't find under Rule 403 that the fact that he jokingly pulled out a gun and made what is admittedly a very bad joke to make to your daughter, but I don't find that the probative value is outweighed by the prejudicial effect. I don't find that. And
was the gun he was using, was this supposed to be the gun he stole from his kindergarten classmate?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. Yes, it was described as by that witness as a silver and black gun. Most of the other witnesses described it as a silver gun. And I will tell Your Honors that a Smith & Wesson 5903, which is what that gun is, a typical Smith & Wesson 5903 is a gun which is an aluminum or stainless steel gun with a black gun grip. So I think most people would describe that as a silver gun, especially if you saw it being handled. But there's going to be a bit of a black at the end of it. So, it's not like she's describing a dark black gun or a brown gun or some gun that's completely different. She also says she doesn't know that much about guns. So,
What guns was Ms. Miller keeping in her purse?
The same gun.
Just
the same
one
gun. There is a second gun. There is the black gun, a black Llama 45, which is similar to a Colt 45.
Where did that come from?
I'm sorry?
He stole that from somebody. Is that
he stole that from, that's also in the brief. He stole that from a loan shark, a guy named Lee Mandich. That gun he was acquitted of. But we believe he was acquitted of that gun because we had some chain of custody issues. The defendant's strategy was, it was somewhat of an ingenious strategy. She picked up on it here, which is we charged two very specific firearms were stolen. And her defense theory was essentially, look, my client was surrounded by guns. You can't prove that it was these two specific guns that we had. And we had a much stronger chain on the silver gun than we did on the black gun. With the black gun, there was a gentleman who gave it to a stripper who didn't testify, who gave it to – I mean, this was a Maury Povich trial, Your Honors. There's no doubt about that.
Don't forget to add that the old man got his daughter's boyfriend addicted on drugs, and that caused her to break up with him.
That caused her to break up with him. And then she found out. Yeah,
you're
not
missing
anything
here.
I know that, Your Honors. So that's why we believe the Arnold testimony is relevant. And on the Miller testimony, again, Your Honor, Lori Miller's testimony was relevant to show the consciousness of the defendant's guilt, that he's making the statements in front of her. He's admitting to her, even though you were in jail when all this happened, here's how I got this firearm. I stole it from a hotel room. And he's willing to make those statements because he can control her and intimidate her, in addition to the fact that he brought her up from Florida and could presumably call the authorities and get her sent back on the warrant. He's making threats to her. If you tell on me, I'm gonna put you in the ground. So that's relevant to that, in addition to which this witness was well impeached. And Ms. Connor has, I think, inadvertently combined two different statements. The statement of this gun was in my purse, she makes repeatedly up until the time of trial. But the statement of initially, when she's first talked about this, she says that gun clip I brought from Florida. And she backs off on that very, very quickly. And we think that would be relevant to show, look, initially she's afraid of the defendant. Once the defendant is in jail, once the defendant is out of the picture, at that point in time, she no longer feels as threatened. She no longer feels like he can intimidate her, and she therefore can make those statements. And I think the courts have been quite consistent in saying that consciousness of guilt and prior inconsistent statements of a witness are reasons to introduce evidence of threats. The court did make a 403 balancing analysis. The court found that this wasn't over the top, and therefore it was properly admissible. So, again, we think that those two pieces of testimony were both relevant, they were both admissible, and the district court properly found under 403 that they weren't unduly prejudicial. The defendant did raise two other points in her brief about evidence related to Ms. Arnold that was excluded and about the constructive possession instruction. She didn't argue those in either her reply brief or really here on appeal, so I would be content to rest on my brief unless the court has questions about either of those issues, which I'm obviously happy to address.
Well, I assume the constructive possession is her having it in her purse readily accessible.
Yes, our argument, and that was actually how it was argued in closing argument, was that this silver firearm, even though she had it a lot of the time, it was in her purse, it was readily accessible, and he could have it. It was also argued due to the fact that at the time of his arrest, The gun was at his the clip was at his feet, was at the passenger side seat of the car. And, you know, again, the argument is just what the constructive possession instruction says. You don't have to physically be touching the gun or the ammo to be in possession of it. If you know it's right here ready at your feet and can control it, you can have it. So for either of those two reasons, we believe that this instruction was appropriate.
Somebody take a picture of that clip? Is that, did I hear her say something about a picture of the clip on the floor of the car?
There was a picture of the clip that was taken, and it was introduced into evidence. It's one of the exhibits in this case.
Yes, the police took that?
The police did recover the clip. When he was arrested, they didn't find the clip initially. They inventoried the car. They towed the car, and then in the inventory search, that's when they found the clip under the seat of the car. And they took a picture of the clip in the car and outside the car. And they did show that to Ms. Miller in pretrial, and that became an issue during the trial as to whether she was changing her story because she really genuinely remembered or whether she was just saying what was in the picture. But the jury resolved that, obviously, in favor of the government and convicted the defendant.
Thank you, Mr. Holley. And Ms. Connor?
Yes, Your Honor.
Anything further?
A couple of things, Your Honor, and it's one of these cases where I wish we did have a movie of what actually happened at trial, because some of what was said is not accurate. Ms. Miller, for example, her testimony was that the defendant had told her that he obtained a gun from a house. There was a burglary of a house, Mr. Mandich's house. That was the count that the defendant was acquitted of. That was not the gun that was the subject of count three of the indictment. Also, I think it's very important that the statement of threats was never put into context, and therefore the concept of consciousness of guilt never arose. It was actually insinuated that that comment was made long ago and not in relation to these guns at all. Also, though Mr. Benson at the time of closing and at the time of sidebar did argue that Ms. Arnold must be wrong about the time, I believe if the court were to look closely at the record, there's nothing to indicate that Ms. Miller was, in fact, dancing between May 8th and May 15th. I would also point out to the court...
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Connor. And you were appointed, were you not?
Yes,
so we thank you. And we thank Mr. Holler for his excellent argument. We thank the state of Indiana for producing such a colorful collection of characters and events. And our next case.